Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome back to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. I'm your host, Sucheta Kamath. I believe that we must take time to think about our thinking, reflect on our beliefs, actions, and emotions so that we can carve a path for personal success. And particularly, those of us who are responsible for other people should really take that job seriously. A brain that is regulated and settled in equanimity is far superior in its capacity to think, reflect, and problem solve. And as an SLP, speech and language pathologist, cognitive rehabilitation expert, and as an executive function coach, I have dedicated my 25 years of career to figure out how best to help people use their mind to change their circumstances, first for themselves, but then eventually for their communities. As an immigrant, a person of color, by the way, I did not know I was a brown person until I came to this country. So I find that fascinating journey for myself. I find myself that as moving to America, by default, I got brought into the American tapestry of race, class, and privilege, which went unexamined while I was growing up in India. And one particular barrier, as I think about, is how do people do well for themselves? Is it pulling yourself by the bootstraps? Is it by just working hard? Does working hard turn out to be adequate? Or are there some more deeper ways that limitations on one's capacity to do well and reflect and problem solve are hindered? Those are the issues that I have begun to examine more recently. And as I have believed that rehabilitation is teaching people new ways of thinking about their thinking, literally would involve helping people develop awareness. But what has changed within me is I need to become aware as a clinician and as a U.S. citizen that there are a lot of factors that have strong hold on outcomes for people. So with that in mind, it's a great, great joy and pleasure to bring this very special guest to talk about, I don't want to use the word fate, but outcomes in a different light. And are certain groups more susceptible to unfavorable outcomes than the other? So my guest today is Dr. Stephen Niffley, Jr. He is at the Spalding University. He is their chief diversity officer and an associate professor at the School of Professional Psychology. And he also serves as a coordinator for the Collective Care Central Racial Trauma Clinic. Dr. Niffley's area of expertise is research and clinical work with Black males and the treatment of race-based stress and trauma, which we'll dive deep into today. Dr. Niffley also serves as an organizational diversity consultant and works with law enforcement department on addressing conflicts between communities of color and police officers. He has written numerous books, chapters, articles on Black male mental health, Black males and criminal justice, and racial trauma treatment and training, and academic achievement, which deeply interests me. Finally, he was recently selected as one of Louisville's top 40 under 40. Congratulations, Dr. Niffley, for that. And he is also a recipient of 2020 MediStar Healthcare Advocacy Award, in addition to many, many accolades that he brings to the table. One of my favorite books is Out of KOS, which is Knowledge of Self, which I'm really looking forward to talking to him about. Welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, thank you for having me here.
Such a comprehensive background and such deep interest in many, many topics. But you're a psychologist, so I feel very comfortable asking you this question. As we think about executive function development and our agency over our learning, our capacity to self-reflect and strategize to become a successful or maybe a decent learner, what was your experience as a child, adolescent, and young adult as a learner and a thinker?
Sure. So I really didn't have the opportunity to reflect on what it meant for me to be a learner probably until I was maybe a sophomore in college. Before that time, I spent most of my time just trying to fit in and live up to the expectations at the time for what it meant to be a Black male. And if we think about some of the expectations that are connected to being a Black male, it's being this dumb, deviant, or dangerous individual. And so although I knew on some levels that I had some intelligence, I would oftentimes try to find a way to hide that or not live up to those spaces because either A, I didn't want to be made fun of by my peers, or B, I just didn't believe that I had the capacity to do the things that I've seen in other spaces that my peers were able to do. There's this quote that says, what they see is what they'll be.
Yeah.
And for myself, I didn't see what I was able to become in terms of becoming a psychologist until I was really a junior in college. That's when I saw my first Black male doctor and was able to realize the potential that I had inside.
Well, we are very fortunate for you to stick with things and really bring your expertise to us. So I'm glad a lot must have gone into overcoming those stereotypes. So, you know, this is my first question to you, again, as an immigrant and as a woman, being from India, you know, I forgive me for those who are on the video can see this, but when I landed, the question was, are you this Indian or are you this Indian? You know, as if, which is so derogatory, which is pointing out to the red dot on your forehead versus, you know, those who are, you know, kind of, you know, maybe tapping your hand over your mouth, indicating the Indian call. I spend a lot of my young, you know, adulthood in reconciling with that kind of pressure to become somebody so that I'm accepted, but also I'm validated as an expert or considered respect-worthy. But I never questioned it because I was very busy assimilating. So I wanted to first start with this idea that, you know, life experiences for people in the United States, particularly if they're not from the dominant culture, are very distinctly different. But most people who are unaware is the dominant culture, which is maybe the white culture. So I was just curious, can we start with the defining what is race-based stress and trauma?
Absolutely. So it's a unique form of traumatic stress that Black and brown folks experience that comprises three components. The first one is known as aversive hostile racism. So many of us have been able to gain access into privileged spaces, but then are met with interpersonal violence as a way to remind us that we don't deserve to be in those spaces. We then try to tell others around us the interpersonal violence that we're experiencing and are then met with, you're being too sensitive, we don't believe you, you know, you're making things up, which is known as micro-invalidations. So aversive hostile racism, interpersonal violence that's designed to remind us of our places in the racial hierarchy. We then try to tell other folks about that interpersonal violence and then are met with micro-invalidations, so ways in which people try to tell us that systemic racism doesn't exist. And the last component is vicarious racism. Vicarious racism refers to having to bear witness to other folks' experience of racism and discrimination while still having to navigate your own. And so race-based stress refers to having to navigate all three of those components as a Black or brown person here in the U.S. So struggling with aversive hostile racism, struggling with those micro-invalidations, then also struggling with the experience of witnessing other folks' experience of racism via vicarious racism. And all that really stresses us out. It can cause significant trauma-like symptoms.
Well, I'm so glad you broke them into three parts. You know, I think one of the distinctions that made sense to me is, you know, really microaggression versus microinvalidation. I think if you don't mind maybe spending a little bit more time on that, because I think we live in a society and by definition, you know, we so seek validation because we want to belong. And there is one way to belong is to be included, but another way to not belong is to be not excluded, but not included. And I think this validation is such an important piece that I never actually thought until I started reading about it. And so I would love to know what kind of impact does that have maybe on the developing mind, but also with adults who are fully developed, because we are one thing you often talk about, we are so busy presenting a fully assimilated and fully coped person. So everything that we are struggle with has to be made invisible. So that must take a big toll on people.
Absolutely. So microaggressions is an umbrella term that really describes the ambiguous racism that we might encounter. So it's subtle in nature, it's interpersonal, and it allows folks to communicate racism and discrimination towards folks in a more covert manner. Underneath the umbrella of microaggressions are three different types. So microvalidations, like we just talked about, when people do not believe or try to discount your experience. There's also microinsults and also microassaults. And so microinsults are the ways in which folks attempt to say that we don't matter in certain ways. So if you were to say, yes, I'm a doctor, and folks were to say, oh, you know, with that kind of like, oh, as in wondering, how can that be? Or if someone was to say or come up to me and ask, how many kids do you have? Versus how do you have kids? You know, that's a microinsult.
Oh, wow.
Because
oh, wow.
Underneath that is this idea that they assume that I have kids because I'm a black male, because black males, they think, have a lot of kids. So those are microinsults. Microassaults are the subtle ways in which we communicate interpersonal violence towards folks. So, for example, utilizing a word such as thug, although on the surface that is a race neutral word, we oftentimes utilize that word only when we're referring to black males between the ages of 18 and 24.
Wow.
And it's been able to replace some of the more racially charged words that have been used in the past. So microaggressions is an umbrella term to describe kind of subtle slights and insults that we offer towards folks of different marginalized backgrounds. Underneath that are microinsults, microassaults, and also microinvalidations. What the science is telling us is that microaggressions cause harm because of the sheer frequency in which they happen for black and brown folks. Sue and colleagues have referred to it as a death by a thousand cuts.
Mm.
What we know for our youth of color specifically is that they encounter microaggressions early on in their lives. Typically, they've experienced their first awareness of microaggressions between the ages of 4 and 6. And from that time until they transition into adulthood, will ultimately experience around 6 microaggressions a day as they try to navigate their lives as black and brown folks. What the science is telling us is that this can have a significant impact on our executive functioning, as you've mentioned here, because of the stress that is connected to having to navigate microaggressions on a daily basis. And so there's the experience of cortisol and those dynamics that influence that.
So when somebody endures that and it just is unrelenting, there is no stopping this. You know, it could be simply while you're walking in the hallways as a child. It is could be the teacher. You know, both my sons went to a private school, majority Christian school, and there was not, you know, They're Americans, but they were called Indians, even though they were not. And also there's a secondary, which is we are Hindus. So talking about, you know, religion in that context. So, and almost the one disparity that I see that the recipient is made to feel that you're making a big deal, which you talked about this hypersensitivity, being called hypersensitive. And I really, you know, I spent a lot of my time in as a young person who was extremely observant, being blamed for protesting, that was often converted into you're being too sensitive when I was perceptive. So that to me also can be very painful. That means the very mechanism that you access is to say something is then turned into something invalidating tool. So I will talk about how to maybe manage that better, but what can we talk a little bit about the dominant group and their attitude towards these experiences, which they're one, not privy to, but second, they that requires a lot of thinking and reflection. So how to make, because one of the things I saw in the communities, particularly leadership community, I saw is people after George Floyd's death, there was some sort of desire to for racial healing. But people looked to black and brown people to say, what do you think we should do? And that to me is also a form of burden that you're deflecting. So I'm sure you have some better ways to think about that. So what do you think we should make of that?
Sure. So one of the challenges in asking black and brown folks what we should do about it is that we can't dismantle a system that we didn't build. You have the blueprints, you have the tools in order to construct it and to deconstruct it. I don't have those tools. You picked me up from where I was from. You carried me into your house. And you told me that I needed to stay here for generations. There's nothing I can do to dismantle it in the same way that you could easily dismantle it by using the tools that you use to create it. And so I think that's one of the difficulties for us to kind of reflect on in the space. Another challenge lies in the fact that privilege is essentially the water that many of us swim in. And so it's hard for us to be aware of something that has been around us our entire lives. As I think about being a male or a cisgender male, I reflect on how the world was created in a way to make life easier for me in terms of representation, in terms of being able to always have voice and choice in different spaces, at least based on being a male. And about how that's been something I've just taken for granted because it's always been the way that things have always been. And so if we're in this space now where folks are saying that the way things have always been has caused difficulty for me, it's hard for me to see that because, well, it's always been that way. I've just taken it for granted. If it's always been that way, and then you say things are harmful because of that, then if I acknowledge that that has caused harm for you, then I then have to take ownership of doing something about it. I can't just ignorantly swim around in the water and say, I don't know what's going on, because now I've been made aware that this water that we're swimming in is good for some folks and bad for many folks out there. And no one really wants to take that type of responsibility because it's hard work to dismantle systems of racism. It takes a long time to build a house. And it takes an equal amount of time to dismantle a house as well.
You know, this reminds me of a psychologist who studied a small tweak. If there was a man in a boardroom and when he was conducting a meeting, if he started with a woman who was a minority in presence and asked her opinion first rather than waiting for her, or it often happens when the dominant group is present, the non-dominant group members tend to hang back or not participate. And one of the ways to counter that is to give them an opportunity and not really believe that that opportunity is going to somehow make somebody lose their privilege. I see that as twofold, as you mentioned. One is there is a psychological responsibility to really examine the privilege and show some willingness to give that up. But second is also some specific steps that can be taken. If we can talk a little bit about the next thing that comes in line to me is the development of identity. So I've been thinking a lot about, you know, the process that goes into developing a white identity versus a racial, a minority racial identity. Can you talk us through that? And what are those differences? And often, if you look at education, there is nothing built into education that addresses two different paths for people, particularly children as they are developing, while we talk a lot about agency, like, you know, become self-reliant, become self-sufficient, get organized, pursue your goals. But as if you're supposed to do that without any attention being paid to your mental, social, psychological health.
Absolutely. So when it comes to the identity for people of color, there's three tasks that is designed to address. Affirmation, teaching of coping strategies for systemic racism, and then also the transference of a historical narrative. So affirmation, coping, and the transference of a historical narrative. And so those are the main tasks that we're trying to attempt through this process called racial socialization, which is the ways in which we attempt to teach our youth about who they are as people of color. And so the first thing we're trying to teach them is that they should be proud of who they are as Black or brown folks, which is the affirmation part. There have been different mantras that people have used within the Black community saying things like, I'm Black and I'm proud, you know, I'm proud of my hair, you know, kind of all those type of things to remind us that who we are is special and is something that deserves to be affirmed and recognized. Coping, go ahead.
That's great.
Yeah, sure. Coping talks a lot about because systemic racism exists, that we have to learn how to cope with it in a way that is meaningful for us and is also adaptive. And so there have been two different ways in which we've attempted to teach our youth. One is called racial legacy skills. And the other one is called racial literacy. Racial legacy refers to teaching folks to be aware that racism is going to happen. Racial literacy, on the other hand, says that it's more of an assertiveness skill set that says this is what you should do when racist things happen to you. Many of us are just leaning into racial legacy and have to move into a racial literacy space. So affirmation, coping, and the last piece is passed on a historical narrative. So especially in today's time where we are starting to lose ground when it comes to talking about the bad things that have happened in the past here in America, it's even more important now that we're sitting down and we're having conversations about the genocide of indigenous folks, about child slavery for Black and brown folks, about the difficulties immigrant folks, a variety of places have had, Japanese internment camps, you know, Chinese Exclusion Act of 1954, just making sure that we're having conversations around all of those things. Because it reminds us that there's a history here that it explains some of the systemic racism that we're encountering. So when it comes to developing a racial identity for a Black and brown person, the goals are to affirm, to teach coping strategies, and to pass on the historical narrative.
So one question about this, affirmation process, we have a lot of literature that talks about students of color having teachers of color having a positive impact. We also know, for example, students with disability getting education as amongst other students with disability have better outcomes for them. But we are not transposing some of the best practices that we deploy for students with disability to racial healing. Do you see a way that we can bring that wisdom that we have taken a lot of time to study, how children develop skills when there are barriers to learning? And I feel racial identity or trauma is definitely a barrier for self-potentiating for every child. But we're not using those best practices. What are your thoughts about that?
Sure. Probably the biggest barrier is just representation, both in terms of what our teacher force looks like, and then also the curriculum that is used to pass on education to our youth. What we're aware of right now is that somewhere around 88% of our public school teachers identify as white, and about 80% of them identify as white women. And so it's really hard to create a space where our youth are able to see themselves and their educators if everybody doesn't look like them in the spaces in which they exist. So that's the first part of representation. The other part of representation refers to the curriculum that we utilize within our school settings. Oftentimes, our students are aware of the Shakespeare's and, you know, other types of white authors, but are unaware of the Black and Brown authors that are out there, like the Toni Morrisons and the Audre Lordes and bell hooks and all those type of folks that have really created, you know, meaningful literature, both fiction and nonfiction, that communicates the Black and Brown experience. But our youth are typically not exposed to those things. First, it comes because their teachers are not exposed to those things, and so do not think to teach that type of material. What we know is that when our youth are able to see themselves, especially our youth of color, are able to see themselves in their curriculum, they're more likely to be involved. That reduces school apathy and increases academic achievement. But our youth can't do that if we're not being intentional, both in terms of creating representation in our teacher force, but then also increasing representation of youth of color and people of color in our curriculum.
You know, this reminds me of Princeton Classics Department. One of the professors there, a person of color, actually talked about, you know, how our psyche is shaped, right? What we call Western philosophy and who is writing it and what we consider golden standard. And one of the things that he pointed out that during Roman or Greek-Roman period, statues were of color. They had color, and eventually that those marble was, you know, cleaned out so to look white, so that whiteness began as an identity, something that you began to have reverence for. So when you do these kinds of systematic steps were taken, but if we never revisit them, we are actually, to your point, you know, losing an opportunity to bring this historical significance. Why do I not see, you know, even when I go to different museums, I see everything pristine, but whiteness as an idealized a color, because race ultimately comes down to color and privilege. Do you see that as one of the, you know, pervasive method of communicating what is considered normal and ideal?
Sure. I mean, it's even present within our dictionary definitions between white and black. You know, if you look in the dictionary, white is seen as good and clean and pure and kind of all those type of things. But if you look in the dictionary under black, it's dirty, it's dark, it's devious. And so if those are the terms that we're using to describe people based on these racial backgrounds, then we've already set up an expectation that white folks are a certain way and that black folks are a different way.
So we should really talk about now the impact of this racial trauma, because it not only we now have ample literature, particularly the science, because of the neuroscience, that we know it has tremendous impact on individuals and as well as groups. So can we maybe can you share some of the research that's out there that talks about the way it impacts the brain of an individual, the health of physical, mental, psychosocial, constitution of a person, also then there's added layer of perceptions. Well, because of perceptions, you know, one particular thing I have been talking a lot about with my contemporary colleagues is overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis. You know, who are we diagnosing with to have a disability, and then who is actually considered not gifted and qualifying for a certain type of specialized services, because all this is access, right? And who we are using, I mean, you are a psychologist, I'm a speech language pathologist, we are using measures which are standardized for thousands of children, but what is the representation in that? So we are using baseline that may not be valid or need to be questioned. So can you share some of those ideas with us?
Absolutely. So there are two main areas in which folks are impacted by the experience of racism and discrimination. in regards to their psychological health and also their physical health. When it comes to our psychological health, similar to other types of traumatic disorders, we struggle when it comes to hypervigilance and intrusive thinking, difficulty concentrating, challenges with our emotional expression, etc. Those kind of challenges with emotional expression, difficulty concentrating and focusing are always important places for us to focus on, because that's typically where our misdiagnoses or overdiagnoses happen. We are working with youth and they are referred to us for an ADHD diagnosis or for an anger management type of issue. It's important for us to reflect on and to evaluate if this person has experienced some form of trauma, because there's some potential overlap between the two, where a traumatized kid might appear having difficulty concentrating, when really what they're focusing on is hypervigilance and managing intrusive thoughts. Additionally, a kid that is struggling with anger might be utilizing the skill set that they were socialized to use, especially as males, when it comes to anger and aggression. What we know is that there's this term out there called alexithymia. Alexithymia refers to having lost or limited ability to communicate your emotional experience to others. And so that happens oftentimes when we experience a trauma. And so if I've been traumatized based on my racial background, and I've also subsequently been socialized to only communicate anger and aggression as emotions, how much more so am I going to use those skills when I've lost the ability to communicate other parts of my emotional experience? And so then, instead of looking at that as a potential kind of outcome, we instead see these kids as behavioral management type of issues and use a different type of intervention. So that's the kind of psychological component. The physical component.
Can I just interject with one more idea, if you can shed some more light, is also then the way we punish. So one of the most important things in schooling experience is how you cooperate in a larger group setting and how you engage, right? So a lot of children who are getting suspended or kind of receiving infractions are for those behaviors, which may be immediately perceived as a lack of respect and as if the culture has not taught how to respect authority, versus in different contexts, this might be just considered like impulsivity and lack of attention, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct. In the we have two questions that we can ask in the school setting when a kid brings in kind of trauma-influenced behaviors. We can ask, what's wrong with you, or we can ask, what's happened to you?
Mm.
When we ask the question, what's wrong with you, that leads to that dynamic of utilizing more containment practices as part of our disciplinary processes, where we focus on detentions, suspensions, and expulsions. When we ask the question instead, what's happened to you, that leans into this idea that there are external factors that are influencing that youth behavior, and that we need to instead utilize social-emotional skill-building components to help that kid to better navigate those type of difficult environments.
Yeah, I consult with this district where they are with their alternative school. And by definition, a child comes to an alternative school because they have reached some threshold of tolerance, like the system has said, this is it. You seem to be not learning and you've become a nuisance to other people's ability to learn. But when they arrive in this alternative setting, they are not being taught. They are not able to pay attention, but all the work is now you are self-taught. So you need to finish the quota of your work so that you can get passing grades so that you can return to school. To me, that now is a huge disadvantage because you're not being taught. And one of the best ways we learn is vicarious learning. Engaged learning is becoming curious, somewhere you get to challenge information or reflect on your thinking. So to me, as a punishment, one of the same thing that we do with suspensions is we remove the child from the opportunity to learn as a way to somehow teach the lesson that needs to be learned, which is a terrible way that we have crafted this system. So sorry, I know you were on to the second topic, which is the physical effects as well. So just wanted to share that as well with you.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, thank you for that. Really, in a lot of ways, All that dynamic is preparing our youth for is the prison setting.
Yes.
Because that's essentially what happens there. When people deem that your behavior is too outside of the norm, you're removed from the population and you're put into a space where you also have to do similar things in the way that we've talked about the alternative schools here.
Yes, go ahead.
So when it comes to the physical component, what we know is that there's this hormone in our body called cortisol. And cortisol is a stress hormone that helps us to fight, flight, or freeze in difficult situations. We all have cortisol. It helps us to manage very dangerous situations. However, for Black and Brown folks, because we've encountered more dangerous situations ongoing across our lifetimes and across the lifetimes of our ancestors, we typically have a higher baseline of cortisol in our bodies. What we know is that high levels of cortisol can contribute to all types of physical health-related issues, such as insomnia, hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, fatigue, migraines, acid reflux, et cetera, all kind of stress-related issues. The interesting thing is that these types of difficulties related to cortisol are generationally transmitted. They are encoded in our DNA. It can lead to chronic illnesses such as cancer. It can contribute to cancer. And also, it seems to be a U.S. effect where we've seen studies where African immigrant women who gave birth to their children in Africa would then come over here, and then we would follow their generations of kids. And with each generation, the kids would be smaller and the kids would be born earlier. And so there's something insidious about the experience of cortisol and its connection to the experience of racism and discrimination, that it impacts the experience of immigrant folks as they try to navigate their spaces here.
I think that's just simply profound. You know, I read this particular reference that a pregnant cow, they studied, this is of course veterinarian science, but when was electrocuted, I mean, there were fences created, electric fences to keep them contained, but a pregnant cow who experiences a shock, the calf 3 generations later still carries that memory. And if that is true about animals, I'm sure some part of that can be applied to humans as well. So I feel what you're talking about is deep genetic changes that we begin to see in generations to come. And that is to me also, you know, when we talk about creating the tomorrow's leaders, you know, talk about most successful and prepared generation of students for to handle 21st century. To me, if we do not address this, we are really not going to create prepare a nation to become most mindful, thoughtful, and with great humility. And we are missing the mark on it so much. And I hope people listen to experts like you and really take that calling seriously, because almost they're like, people are like thinking those two exist in some other sphere of operation somehow. So let's continue in terms of, as we think about effects on an individual when their physical and psychological impact, but groups are also showing that as, right, as communities. Because ultimately, when we think about Paulo Freire, who says, you know, read the word to read the world. So that consciousness, when we talk about raising your social awareness, is one of the ways to kind of take charge of systemic oppression. But groups' capacity to do that also needs some power there.
Absolutely. So what ends up happening for many of us is we are constantly in the space of a survival mode rather than a thriving mode. If we think about, at least for Black folks here, our earliest experiences with chattel slavery, our ancestors tried their best to cope in those situations by utilizing a skill known as compartmentalization. And compartmentalization essentially refers to saying, I'll deal with this at a later time because I just don't have the emotional or the cognitive space to process that at this, you know, at this moment. The difficulty with that is that we never got around to processing those experiences And so we would then just pass on that trauma to the next generation of folks who would then encounter their own experiences related to racism, discrimination, et cetera, utilize compartmentalization as a coping strategy, and then say, well, we'll just deal with that at a later time, but we'll then just pass that on. And so now we have today's generation of folks who are holding all these boxes of trauma. And if you think about what it looks like to hold a bunch of boxes, it's really hard for you to move. You can't see anything but those boxes. And if you were to set those boxes down, you wouldn't want to open them because you're so, you know, it's just like, I don't want to deal with all that right now. And so what we've created is a whole generation of folks that are having to hold all of these components, these trauma narratives, and still have to navigate their own experiences in the world, which creates that more survival tactic rather than finding a way to thrive in these type of systems.
Well, maybe I hope people listening don't get exhausted thinking about the complexities involved here. But you also have given a lot of thought about how to manage it. And we should not lose hope, or particularly, I think we should not lose sight of the big picture. And that's, to me, also is the executive function. You know, how do you maintain a sense of commitment to the bigger outcomes and tolerate immediate and intermediate discomfort and challenges or hard work is the art of well-regulated executive function. So what do you recommend we do with all the things that we are embedded in having to acknowledge and then heal from racial trauma?
So we have our collective care center here. At Spalding, we are a racial trauma clinic that focuses on treatment, education, and service related to the experience of race-related stress and trauma. And so as a part of that, there for our youth ages 6 to 12, we're really trying to encourage three areas of support: advocacy, awareness, and affirmation. And so those are the skills that we need to be teaching our youth in order for them to be successful in these spaces. When it comes to our adults, it's all about teaching the development of racial identity, creating those spaces for processing racial trauma, and then also teaching folks the skills that are needed to navigate racist and discriminatory spaces by utilizing microinterventions for microaggressions, utilizing racial literacy skills, et cetera. And so there are treatment approaches out there that allow us to provide healing to folks that have experienced racial trauma across the lifespan. And there are also assessment tools out there to help us to make a distinction between PTSD, ADHD, behavior management disorders, then also racial trauma as well. So we're here. Centers like ours are ready and willing to help.
And thank you for doing that, and thank you for starting. And I do have a question about your other role as a diversity officer. But before that, I thought I'll share an interesting conversation I recently had a chance to listen to. It was a conversation with Dr. Dixon Chibanda, I think, if I'm pronouncing it right. He's a psychiatrist from Zimbabwe. And he actually has managed to study this, but he recognized the lack of mental health resources in the community in Africa, and particularly one of his adolescent patient who he thought should and recommended that should come and see her was experiencing deep depression and suicidal ideation, but the bus fare was $10 and could never get to him. And the next time he heard about her was that she had committed suicide. And that was so traumatic to him. So he thought and thought, how can he do this when we don't have enough professionals and the amount of money it goes into accessing care? So he started this project with involving the community, particularly elderly women, and for their listening capacity, for the role they play, and the kind of life experiences they have, so somebody to banter with. And so he came up with an idea of a mental health bench. So anybody who needed could sit there. And so these wise women kind of called him aside and said, "Doc, listen, this is a bad idea to call a bench mental health bench. Nobody's going to come." And so then he changed that to friendship bench. And that was seen to have incredible shift in the community where you get to hear people with wisdom, but you also get to talk about your personal and private experiences. And who better but somebody like a grandmotherly person in the community? So I just feel we need friendship benches in America. You know, we have a deep and grave need. We don't have enough qualified people, but we also are looking at mental health as a compartmental approach to quality of life. Everybody should have safe, but more so, bold places to talk about our mental anguish and acknowledge those who are not a majority or minority have even greater psychosocial burden and physical burden. So, are you aware of any such project we are thinking about in America more globally rather than, you know, as a clinic, which also creates a more deficit-based model in thinking about mental health?
Sure. So here in the city of Louisville, and also has become a national project, is that many folks are partnering with barbers. Barbers are seen as trusted folks here within the Black community. So these are typically the folks that you would go to have pretty intense conversations with, because you're sitting in the chair for an hour or so, and you just get to talking about stuff, and it's a safe place to do that. And so there's a lot of training going on with barbers to teach them mental health first aid skills, to where they can, evaluate and assess and communicate and then connect folks to the resources that they need from a trusted individual. And that reduces some of the pathology connected to it, because it's not a trained mental health professional that's doing that. It's someone that you might trust a little bit more because they take care of your hair. But that's a project that I've seen that has had some significant success.
Oh, I love that. Yes, that means I, as a woman, are going to miss out on that conversation. We should start this with hair salon too. that's great. So I do want to, as we come to an end of our conversation now, I do want to talk to you about your role as a diversity officer. And one, I would love to know, what does that entail, particularly when it comes to professionals wanting to become partners with minorities and creating bold workplaces? But also, I feel, I just want to get some insight from you. There's a lot of desire to address it using a diversity officer without changing the culture. I'm sure you will not be that person, because you have deep and wide knowledge, but I feel sometimes systems are much bigger than the individual's recommendations. And a lot of friends of mine who are diversity officers talk about that, that systems feel comfortable. Whoosh, we did something about this, you know? So do you have any thoughts about that?
Sure. So there's a big difference between throwing a rock in a pool and allowing it to ripple, versus throwing a rock at a frozen pool and it just bounces off. And so if we imagine what an effective chief diversity officer looks like in those spaces, it's someone that has the ability to create a ripple within a system that will lead to a lasting change. Mm. The worry always is that we are creating a whole bunch of rocks that are just going to bounce off of frozen ponds. And so we want to create a space where chief diversity officers are able to have the impact that is needed to address these systems when it comes to racism, sexism, ableism, heterosexism, et cetera. And so the ways in which we do that is by making sure that those folks are supported when it comes to financial resources, personnel resources, and with the influence and weight of the leadership that they're connected to, because that's indeed how the ripple happens.
Brilliant. And so how are you enjoying your role as a diversity officer? And do you have some examples for us? How you think about changing systems or preparing people to be partners to change the systems?
Absolutely. So I've really been enjoying my role here. I've been a diversity consultant for almost 10 years at this point, and it's been an honor to work with the system more long term that I'm also influenced by and connected to. Some projects that have really been meaningful to me are are really working on evaluating what the culture of our system looks like and providing evidence and assessment support to give us a baseline as to where we are and where we need to go, providing and creating spaces for conversation through book clubs and, through dynamics such as that, providing training opportunities to learn how we can foster a more inclusive environment as faculty members and as staff persons, as leadership, et cetera. And also just making sure to amplify the voices of marginalized folks by making sure to tell their story and making sure that they have spaces to tell their stories as well. Have all been places where I've been very fortunate to offer some impact.
Well, they're very lucky to have you. And I'm excited to see in what direction you take this work and literally help transform our communities. Before I let you go, I would love to know if you can share with our listeners some of your favorite books, reads that have influenced your mind or have been meaningful to you.
Sure. I'm trying to think about what those are. The Pedagogy of the Oppressed has been a really meaningful book for me by Paulo Freire. This book here called No Pity by Joseph Shapiro has been a meaningful book that talks about disability rights and activism in that area. Black Skin, White Mask by Franz Fanon has been really helpful. I think those are some initial books that really kind of stand out to me. The initial book that I always recommend to anybody is The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. That's been a really meaningful book to my own development as a diversity professional.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you. Well, all right. That's all the time we have. Thank you again, Dr. Nifley, for being our guest here. As you can see, folks, these are very important conversations we are having with highly knowledgeable, incredibly qualified, and passionate experts with unique perspective on executive function, but not just in a limited sense for personal growth, but societal change. And that's why here are a few things you can do to promote our message and these valuable conversations. If you love what you're listening to, definitely share this episode with your friends and colleagues. If you have a moment, definitely take a moment to write a review. And finally, subscribe to Full Prefrontal using your favorite app. Definitely, that will be a way to not miss an episode. Thanks once again. Look forward to seeing you all right here next time on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.